Okay, let's gather up some answers on this, shall we? We'll start over here.
Yeah, say that. That's very helpful.
So who's going to say it? You are. Good. They can't hear you over there. Partly because Barrage is being rude, but partly because the others... There we go. Loud voice.
Pot stirrer?
A pot stirrer. Yeah. Right? Like in porridge every morning.
Someone who enjoys causing division.
Somebody who enjoys causing division. Yes, that's very negative, isn't it? Yes?
Someone who draws hard lines.
Somebody who draws hard lines.
Someone who challenges the norm.
Who challenges norm, whoever he is.
Someone who says something to be provocative.
Someone who says things in order to be provocative, which is like this kind of divisive guess.
Someone said you might be a controversialist.
This is such a nice looking group.
Trying to be a bit controversial.
What was the name of the person who said this about me, yes? You didn't hear long enough.
Someone that argues and enjoys it.
Somebody who argues and enjoys it.
Someone who says things to provoke discussion.
Somebody who says things to provoke discussion. Any other advances we have then? Second round. Okay, you see how it's not liked now because it has a negative connotation. It's the person who actually likes to pick fights, who enjoys the quarrels, who is divisive by nature. But the word actually just meant somebody who sparks controversies or enters into controversies. They may or may not enjoy it. They may not themselves be the divisive person, but they are in, and that's where you're right, they are in division. They create division because they go against the norm, because they're saying things that are unusual, unexpected, different kind of things than the normal kind of politically correct statements of the day and the age. It's got to do with these words themselves, you see. Controversy is a prolonged public disagreement or heated discussion. The controversialist is the person who's in a prolonged public disagreement or a heated discussion. And the controversial means giving rise to, or likely to give rise to, controversy or public disagreement, such as how do you pronounce the word? No. See, that itself these days is something that is controversial. That's because, so my dictionary says, there are two possible pronunciations of controversy: controversy or controversy. The former pronunciation is more traditional, old man, but the latter is more now widespread in the British English speaking world, which is the whole world. So are you a controversy person or are you a controversy person? Of course, there's no right and wrong other than saying it the way I do. So there is about controversy, and Jesus is somebody who is always in controversy. He sparks it, but he's also caught up in it at the same time. Well, let's put Jesus back in the context of the Gospels themselves, and Tony's going to come and speak to us about what we did last week to remind ourselves where we're up to. Sometimes Jesus responds to controversies, and sometimes he initiates controversies. We're going to look at chapters 10, 11, 12 of Mark, where you'll find him as the controversialist, and divide your group so that there's three twos there. So it's not hard to work that out, is it? There's about six people in every group except over there, and they've got seven, but they're clever, they can work it out. It's a perfect number. And so divide yourselves up and read. Two of you read chapter 10, two of you read chapter 11, two of you read chapter 12, and work out where Jesus responds, not initiates, where he responds to controversy. He could be responding to a controversy that exists between groups, or he could be responding to a controversy that people are throwing at him. So where is he responsively controversial? Understand the concept of the question? Away you go. Chapters 10, 11, 12. Read quickly. Scan. Who can tell me about Jesus responding to a controversy in chapter 10? Which one's it about? Or which ones? Yes?
We said verse 2, the Pharisees testing Jesus.
Yes, the Pharisees test Jesus about divorce. That's because the Pharisees were fighting with each other. The school of Gamaliel were fighting the school of Hillel as to on what grounds could you have a divorce and on what grounds could you remarry after divorce. And so they called Jesus into that controversy, right, knowing that he's going to put one side off the side of the other, whichever way he comes down. They call him into that controversy, but notice they do it in order to test him. What else in chapter 10? That was the main one. I wanted to pick up. What did you pick up?
I picked up the children.
The children. It's not a controversy, but it is, yes.
The disciples are refusing them.
They're refusing them. He accepts them.
Jesus has to engage in that.
Yep. Good. What about chapter 11? What did you find in chapter 11? Yep.
Where Jesus goes into the temple and he sees people turning into a market, he decides to fight fire with fire.
He does fight fire with fire, but I think that's where he initiates controversy rather than responds to it. He responds to sinfulness. Yeah? What else do you find in chapter 11?
When Jesus' authority is challenged.
Yes, for doing that. Yeah, that's right. Where they say, by what authority are you doing this? Yeah? And in chapter... where else in chapter 11 have we got any others?
Yeah, we've got the chief priests and the scribes being mad about the temple thing, and then he responds by leaving the city.
Yes, okay. That's a response. Yeah. What about chapter 12? What did you find there? Yep.
We see three instances where Jesus is engaged with different groups of Jewish leaders.
Yep.
So with the Pharisees and Herodians, they were paying taxes.
Yes, should you pay taxes or not? Because under Jewish law, you shouldn't be handling Roman money or idolatry money, etc. And so, again, it's to test him. It's a trap. If he says, no, you shouldn't pay taxes, well, he'll be reported to the Romans. If he says, yes, you should pay taxes, well, he's not a true Jew, is he? So he's kind of, they're trying to test him, catch him out, yes? What other ones that you see there in chapter 12? Yes?
There he has the resurrection and the Sadducees.
Yes, the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection, so they give him this hypothetical of the woman who didn't know how to cook. She is rat poison. Well, something like that. She had seven husbands since they all died. That must have been something about her cooking, don't you think? And so the seven husbands die in order to ask the question, which one will be the husband in the resurrection? The resurrection's the next age, in the age to come, you see? Who's going to actually be the husband? And it's, again, a trick question to help show up Jesus as believing something stupid, the resurrection. Yeah? What else do we have in chapter 12?
What is the greatest commandment?
What is the greatest commandment, which is... Sorry? Yes, he gives two options. He mentions two: love God, love your neighbour. It's interesting, in that one, the man who's asked it, testing Jesus again, actually says, you're right. He acknowledges the answer's right, because Jesus perceives that he's not far from the kingdom, that man. It's slightly different than the negative testing in the others. That's right. So you look at these controversies that Jesus is caught up in. People are using controversies that are rolling along, like the fight over divorce or the fight over taxes or these, and trying to pull Jesus in so that they can catch him out in his words. So what does Jesus do in these? It's very interesting, because he keeps refusing to answer in the terms in which the question is asked. Notice that? So instead of on the divorce one, he doesn't say one way or the other. What he says is, you haven't understood the nature of marriage. And so instead of going to the law where the fight is on, he goes to the law right back in Genesis 1 and 2 and says, this is the nature of marriage. You're both wrong. because you haven't understood the nature of marriage. Or on the authority, by what authority do you cleanse the temple? He says, I'll answer your question if you answer my question. On what authority did John the Baptist do what he did? Now he's put them in difficulty. Because if they say, on no authority, well, there's a problem because everyone knew John was a prophet. But if they say, oh, on God's authority, then he'll say, but John the Baptist told you to follow me. So they say, well, we don't know. And so Jesus said, well, I'm not going to answer you. He doesn't say, I don't know. He says, I'm not going to answer you either. Right? He turns the table all the time. The taxes. Give me a coin. Here's this little image. Whose image is this? He's not answering the question. He's saying, whose image is this? And they say, Caesar's. And he says, well, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And give to God what is God's. Well, hang on, what's God's? I know this is the image of Caesar. Where's the image of God? You're the image of God, aren't you? And so the challenge back to them is much greater than the challenge they've had to him. He hasn't answered the question. He's just turned the tables on the questioners. Each time he does the same. The resurrection. He says, well, what does Moses say? Now, the Levites only believed in the first five books of the Old Testament. They didn't accept any of the prophets. 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Samuel. The Sadducees, thank you. They didn't believe any of that. They only believed in the first five books. So he goes to the second book, Exodus. And in Exodus, there's a verse. The verse that comes out of the time with the bush, where God says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Moses. Ha! Not he was, he is. How can he be still the God of them when they're all dead at the time of Moses? You see, he just turns the tables. It's just the character of how he does it. And so what is the great commandment? Well, he takes them to the scriptures there. Now, the turning of the tables, I want to show you with a video from Tim Keller. Now, I don't always agree with Tim Keller and all that Tim Keller taught, but he was a great man. I have a lot of respect for him. He was very kind to me when I met up with him. And he also was very clever, especially in answering questions. Good. You hear him turning the tables all the time on the question? I mean, he does answer the question, but he doesn't answer the question. Right? But he changes the nature of the question. Because the questioner is saying, you do this, you go to hell. He's saying, no, it's if you do that, you go to hell. But you haven't understood. I'm not saying this is good, I'm saying this is bad, but that's not the point. The essence of what sin is about is not breaking this rule, breaking that rule. The essence of what sin is about is rebellion against God. So that's why the second box of our two ways to live is such an important box. Because it's explaining sin without using the word sin. Sin is rebellion against God. Because most of our contemporaries hear the word sin as breaking some particular rule. And then they have a kind of categories of rules that are really bad to break. And by using greed, 10 times more common than adultery in its condemnation, and yet so much harder to see than adultery, he's helping to turn the tables on the discussion that the man is asking. Now that's very Jesus-like. That's how Jesus answers questions. That's how Jesus is controversial. Because he enters into the controversies that are there, doesn't shy away from them, but he doesn't answer them in the terms in which they've been set up. And part of the reason why controversies continue on and on and on and on is because they've been set up falsely. The reason people ask questions very often is because of false assumptions. If they had their assumptions right, they wouldn't have the questions that they have. But because they've got false definitions, false assumptions, they then have questions. Questions are really good. As you know, we have 10 or so here every Thursday night. I'm all for questions. But you'll also notice that I don't always answer them, do I? Don't always answer them in the terms in which you've asked them. because the term in which you asked it was the assumption that was wrong. That's what needs to be shown. So come to the sex element of Jesus' teaching, where he actually initiates controversy. Just look at chapters 11 and 12 this time. Chapters 11 and 12. Those of you who read chapter 10 last time, well done, good on you. Now, one of you read chapter 11, the other read chapter 12. And those who read chapter 12 last time, read chapter 11. Those who read chapter 11 last time, read chapter 12. And look where Jesus initiates a controversy, where he actually pokes the stick. All right, let's pick it up quickly then. In chapter 11, where do we see where Jesus initiates controversy? The cursing of the fig tree, yes. And what did that mean, yes? Is that it? No.
Jesus flipping tables in the temple.
Yeah, turning the tables over in the temple, and that certainly was an action of great controversy. Any others in chapter 11?
He asked for a colt to ride in
on. Yes, the way he came into Jerusalem was controversial. Yeah, that's right.
Like you were saying before, when he refuses to answer on what authority he does.
Well, that's how he responds to it, rather than initiates it, I think. It's a subtle difference, which is no difference, yes?
In a way, the way he talks about prayer, like saying to a mountain, like, ask it to move and it will move.
Yes.
He's asking for the genuine question, and then he's like...
Yeah. Okay, we'll come back to chapter 11 in a minute and look at each of those. Chapter 12, where do we see him initiating a controversy? Yeah, he tells a parable. They understood that it's about them at the end of that. He was actually being rude to them. Yep. Yeah, where else?
The greatest son is the Christ. He basically implies himself that he's the one saying David is born to the Lord.
Yes. He shows a puzzle to them. They haven't got the answer. That is, how can David's son be David's Lord? Because the son is not as great as his father, and a grandson's considerably less.
The warning against the pigeons of the Lord.
The
warning against the pigeons of the
Lord. Oh, I've forgotten. What's that saying? Which verse?
38 to...
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
About the...
Beware of the scribes.
Beware of the scribes. But 38 following, it's in particular about money, isn't it? Because it's talking about the widow... who gives half of it, she's giving her money. They just look like they're giving money. Yep. Okay, let's...
And then the widow's offering.
The widow's, approving the widow's offering. Okay. In each of these, again, he's turning tables, even though the tables haven't been given to him. He's just showing them, you've got it all back to front. So he comes in with this huge crowd on a donkey. Because that's what Zechariah prophesied the Christ would do. But by coming in on a donkey, he's claiming to be the Christ. And so he's setting himself up, and the crowds are calling, Hosanna, Hosanna. A little later, the scribes are going to say, shut the crowds up. And he says, oh, I can't. You know, out of the mouths of babes and infants come the praises of God. The fig tree is really interesting one, isn't it? It's only the disciples who see it, not the crowds. But... in cursing the fig tree, and then next day when they look, the fig tree is all withered. What's he saying? He's saying if you have the faith to move this mountain, you can actually move it at this point. Now again, it's important you know your Old Testaments, because he doesn't say move a mountain, he says move this mountain. The mountain he's standing on at that moment is the Mount of Olives. And in Zechariah chapter 14, we're told, when the great day comes and the kingdom of God arrives, Mount of Olives is going to be split in two and thrown aside. And he's now saying, Yes, this is the moment for the cleansing of the temple. This is the moment when the kingdom of God comes. This is the moment when the fig tree is going to be cursed. The judgment's going to fall upon the people, and the salvation is going to come with the movement of the mountain, like Zechariah 14. You miss the little word this, and you don't know Zechariah 14, you miss the point of what's being said. Right, it's about this is the moment. That's why he goes on to talk about it in the next verse. Be forgiven, seek forgiveness. Because when the kingdom comes, it comes in judgment. When it's coming in judgment, make sure you're on the side of being forgiven, or you're going to have problems. Right? So but it's only for the disciples, that one. Well, the cleansing of the temple, of course, is a terrible put down. This is the house of prayer for all nations. And you've turned it into a pigsty. I mean, this is just dreadful. You're just making money. And the attack on money making then comes later. The scribes, in their great wealth, they give lots of money, but actually they don't give much at all. Ever checked out Bill Gates? He gives millions. Ever checked out how much he makes? He makes millions every minute. The amount he's actually giving is quite small. The percentage, the amount is huge, the percentage is negligible. He doesn't even feel it. Am I criticizing? I'm glad he's doing it. But I'm not going to laud him as one of the most generous people in the world, because a little person who gives most of what they earn away is considerably more generous. Wilberforce, and I can't remember if it was William Wilberforce or John Newton, I think it was Wilberforce, said that if your giving does not hurt you, you haven't yet been generous. Very important principle, isn't it? That generosity is of a different character. And then he puts this, he lays down the question for them, which they can't answer. How can David call his son Lord? Because David is his father. And the answer is in the person of Jesus himself. And you'll notice, after verse 34, just before he puts the puzzle to them, after that, no one dared to ask him any more questions. Yeah, they're losing all the time. What does Jesus' method do? You see, in his response, he doesn't answer questions, but he challenges the assumptions upon which the questions are built. In his initiation of controversies, he's always applying the Old Testament word to the situation. He's always showing, hang on, what about this part of the Bible? What about this part? What about Psalm 110? What about Zechariah 9? What about Zechariah 14? He's showing, he is fulfilling the Old Testament in ways that your ignorance of the Old Testament means you don't get it. You don't see what's there in front of you. And so he establishes his Old Testament authenticity to the claim of being the Christ. He shows you the nature of the kingdom and the nature of the Christ. He forces decisions upon people, whether they're for him or against him. But he also inevitably creates the rejection that will see him crucified, because he alienates people in the process by putting them down, showing them up, if you can have that mixed metaphors. That only alienates people in what he is doing and how he does it. But that is the Jesus who was there. He was a very troubling, puzzling man for those who are outside. And even for those insiders, if they don't have it explained to them, they don't get it either. Most of you never knew about the Mount of Olives and split in two and Zechariah 14, right? Well, you're in good company. I don't think the disciples knew either. You're not in good company, because it's 2,000 years later, you should have learnt by now. However, it's good that you have now. So that's where it is. You see, Jesus is constantly teaching who he really is in such a way that alienates people. Fascinating. But he turns the table, and in that he gives examples. Now, next week, we're going to be looking at his teaching. Not his controversies, his teaching. But when you look at his teaching, you realize actually he was controversial all the time. He was saying things that just were really strange. Special guest presenter next week. Don't miss it. We're having a special guest presenter for a couple of reasons. One, because he's brilliant at this particular topic. And secondly, because I'm up at Katoomba, freezing, to speak at Triple M, MMM next week on Exodus. So if you like to pray for me sometime, I'd be very appreciative of that. Year 11, year 12 kids at Triple M is where I'll be speaking next Thursday afternoon, night, all next week actually, and a great place to encourage people to go to launch next year, because half of them are year 12 kids, so very important that I'm encouraging them on to launch as well as teaching them on Exodus. But I will not leave you alone. I have actually organized an expert on the teachings of Jesus to come and tell you and show you what it is and how controversial it is. Don't miss out. He's really good. Let me go to the answers to your questions.